Good morning, everyone, and welcome to ULT in Philadelphia, one of many largest situated all over the globe. Purpose is to spread broadcast the teaching of theosophy as recorded in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. Therefore, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles to a true realization of the self, a profound conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity, without distinction of race or creed or sex, condition or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. And if you pick up one of these wonderful little pamphlets, just below the declaration is the form signed by associates of the United Lodge of Theosophists. Very plainly put, being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge as set forth in its declaration, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate, it being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part other than that which I myself determine. The work on hand. Today being October the 30th, the last day, Sunday in October, the topic will be an introduction to the secret doctrine. Wednesday meetings, the library opens at 5:15 and is open to 7:15. Class begins at 7:30 and is over at 8. At the present time, for the next few weeks, it will be in that wonderful text called The Key to Theosophy by H.P. Blavatsky. Classes are open to all students and visitors alike. Now, out front in the middle hall, you'll see a book table, and there'll always be a volunteer there at the book table during library hours. Please stop. The prices, the cost of the printing and the shipping and so forth. And there you'll find literature that you can peruse and choose what you're particularly interested in.
Now slow down to read that. Read that slowly.
Oh yes. We have a reading for you from the preface to the secret doctrine. And repeat these words, the preface. The preface to the secret doctrine, that wonderful volume. It is It's needless to explain that this book is not the secret doctrine in its entirety, but a select number of fragments of its fundamental tenets. But it is perhaps desirable to state unequivocally that the teachings, however fragmentary and incomplete, contained in these volumes belong neither to the Hindu, the Zoroastrian, the Chaldean, nor the Egyptian religion. Neither to Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, nor Christianity exclusively. The secret doctrine is the essence of all of these. The aim of this work may be thus stated, to show that nature is not a fortuitous concurrence of atoms, and to assign to man his rightful place in the scheme of the universe, to rescue from degradation the archaic truths, which are the basis of all religions, and to uncover, to some extent, the fundamental unity from which they all spring. Finally, to show that this occult side of nature has never been approached by the science of modern civilization. If this is in any degree accomplished, the writer is content. It is written in the service of humanity, and by humanity and the future generations, it must be judged. Thank you.
An introduction to the secret doctrine. It sounds so simple, doesn't it? I mean, here it is. Two volumes, 1,474 pages, published in 1888, and still to this day regarded as an amazing masterwork. The reading we heard from the preface begins with, and of course, almost everything we're going to say is a direct quote from HPB, Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. The very first thing she says in the preface is, the author, the writer, rather, immediately telling us she is not the author of this masterwork. So perhaps it's not as simple as it sounded to just have an introduction to this amazing effort. She later uses the words of Montaigne. She says, I have here made only a nosegay of culled flowers and have brought nothing of my own but the string that ties them. In a later work, she says, can anyone say I didn't work hard to provide the string? In her article, My Books, she writes, every word of information found in Isis or any later writings comes from the teachings of our Eastern masters. And many a passage in these works has been written by me under that dictation. In other words, HPB is not the author of the secret doctrine. William Q. Judge wrote, masters have said that they helped her write the secret doctrine so that the future 75 and more years should have some material to work with. And here we are. And that in the coming years, that book and its theories would be widely studied. Now, we may not realize this, but there are many great minds, scientists, thinkers, philosophers, who study this book. They may not give credit to it, but those of us who are students of it recognize their line of thought. And we think one of the reasons they don't give credit to it is they're liable to be frowned upon by others in their field. It's almost professional suicide at times to be found using something of this ilk. Although we all know Einstein has been quoted as respecting it. So the secret doctrine itself is the result of the cooperation of the Brotherhood of Adepts and this individual, which we call HPB. She wrote it down, but the material came from them. When we heard in the reading the purpose of this volume, we can also see this is not simple, friends. There is no simple way to approach this except with that sense of faith that you're going to study something, read something, look into something that you're not familiar with. And all that's asked of you is to bring the same kind of critical judgment that you bring to it, you bring to the ideas you already hold. Put them aside for the moment and then weigh them against each other. So, repeatedly, in this book, we are given the chance of looking at sacred symbols and ideas in stone and philosophy and in religion to see that there was and is one great wisdom. After all, truth must agree with truth. Whether a 2-year-old says it or a 200-year-old building says it, it must agree with itself. And that is the thing that study will bring out for you. Everything in theosophy is logical and consistent and agrees with itself. But you don't have to accept it. You have to study it and think about it. And again in the preface, these truths are in no sense put forward as a revelation, nor does the author, and that's funny, she uses the word author there after telling us that isn't what she was, claim the position of a revealer of mystic lore, now made public for the first time in the world's history. For what is contained in this work is to be found scattered throughout thousands of volumes embodying the scriptures of the great Asiatic and early European religions, hidden under glyph and symbol, and hitherto left unnoticed because of this veil. What is now attempted is to gather the oldest tenets together and to make of them one harmonious and unbroken whole. The sole advantage which the writer has over her predecessors is that she need not resort to personal speculations and theories, for the work is a partial statement of what she herself has been taught by more advanced students, supplemented in a few details only by the results of her own study and observation. The Secret Doctrine has a dedication, and it is, "This work I dedicate to all true theosophists in every country and of every race, for they called it forth, and for them it was recorded." Well, that brings us to the crux of our problems, and that is that we are not yet probably able to consider ourselves theosophists. We're not wise in the wisdom, and we're certainly not consistent in the application of the recognition of unity of life, of compassion. So, how can we solve this? We're students, not yet theosophists. So the book was dedicated to true theosophists. What makes one a true theosophist? Well, certainly being a student is part of it. Some very good advice we were given years ago by a very good student who also did not have a higher education was, as you read it, underline the words you don't know, the phrases in foreign languages that you don't know, and then take the time right then to look them up. Write in the margin what you discover. Each time you come back to reading that part, you will begin to realize you now know those words. You now understand that particular foreign phrase. So unlike those who have a higher education and may recognize more of the vocabulary and maybe even be able to translate some of the foreign languages, we who do not have that background may have less to unlearn. For those with higher education may have learned the opposite of many of these ideas, and they have to work a little harder to get past that. Never thought we would appreciate not knowing something. But, and here we come to the real friend and guide that we have, and that is a pamphlet that was done by a naval commander named Robert Bowen, who studied directly with HPB from 18, did I write that down? I think 1890 or 1889 to 1891. And in that study of the secret doctrine with HPB, he would ask questions and then write down the answers. He took notes. He then, when he had compiled all his notes, went and read them to HPB, and she actually said to him, you've done better than most at understanding these. So we have her words about how to study the secret doctrine. And we have copied the major points of his effort, and they'll be on the usher's table on your way out. You can pick them out so you don't need to take notes if you hear something that's very vital to you. We also, on the other side of that, printed the reading so that you can have that. So, Commander Bowen writes, "Come to the secret doctrine," HPB says, "without any hope of getting the final truth of existence from it, or with any idea other than seeing how far it may lead towards the truth. See and study a means of exercising and developing the mind never touched by other studies." So you're not looking for the full and complete answer. You're looking for how these ideas lead towards the truth. It is also said that such study cultivates the intuition. This is not an intellectual exercise. We often think it is because we have to call upon our intellect to peruse it, but it is an intuitive exercise. Number one point, says Bowen, reading the secret doctrine page by page as one reads any other book, HPB says, will only end in confusion. The first thing to do, even if it takes years, is to get some grasp of the three fundamental principles given in the proem. Now, if you come to our Wednesday night classes, you know that every other Wednesday we have a presentation of the three fundamentals. Not only does the philosophy rest upon the three fundamentals, but so does life, so does reality. So this is a critical learning basis for theosophy. Follow that up by study of the recapitulation, the numbered items in the summing up to volume one, and then take the preliminary notes in volume two and the conclusion. So you're not to read it page by page. You are to go after certain ideas and get grounded in them. We are also warned against turning to others to explain the secret doctrine to us. It is worse than useless going to those whom we imagine to be advanced students, HPB said, and asking them to give us an interpretation of the secret doctrine. They cannot do it. If they try, all they give are cut and dried esoteric renderings which do not remotely resemble the truth. To accept such interpretation means anchoring ourselves to fixed ideas, whereas truth lies beyond any ideas we can formulate or express. Exoteric interpretations are all very well, and she does not condemn them, so long as they are taken as pointers for beginners and not accepted by anything as anything more. So in a very real sense, we are on our own in this study. But isn't that true of everything? I mean, if we were climbing a mountain, even as part of a group, it's our feet, our arms, our legs that have to do the effort to make that climb, even if we are following. So we may have a leader, but it's the effort we make to follow. So in this study of the secret doctrine, we may lean on others. That's perfectly reasonable. What does this mean? What is that? I don't understand this. How does it fit in? We will ask another student, and we take what they say, and usually students are very good at giving us a reference that will help us understand better what we've read. They're not trying to make us understand it, but to understand how we can get there. In one way, the effort that we are making has to have an important motive. If we may start out, I just want to know what the SD is about, and I just want to understand it a little. But our motive becomes to be the better able to help and teach others. And the funny thing about that is it is of benefit to you. It sounds like it's all outward. I'm doing this to try to help others. But until you try to explain something, you don't really understand it yet yourself. So that effort to be able to explain or to offer or to share something requires you to do the studying. So the motive is beneficial to you as well, which sounds really strange. And another thing we probably don't really perceive about this study is studying the secret doctrine changes us. It's that simple. Not only do we increase our vocabulary, and we think Mr. Judge says somewhere that it's equivalent to a college education and more, so we're expanding our mind, but it also changes us. Now, it could be that that comes from making a connection with this great brotherhood of adepts, even through thought, through reaching to their thought, and then the humbling thoughts we may have about them. But it's also, and it's one of the things that seems to drive people crazy about the secret doctrine. You'll be reading a particular subject, and it will jump to something else about another culture or civilization or religion. And people find that frustrating. Well, that could be a way of awakening our own memory and experiences from past lives. We may suddenly feel that we understand it, even though we can't explain it to anyone else, and we can't even explain it to ourselves. In the 18 million years humanity has been on this planet, we have been through many, many, many cultures and experiences, and those can get reawakened without our recognizing it. So the introduction to the secret doctrine is an invitation to grow as a soul and to be part of this great effort. We learn in the Ocean of Theosophy that the masters, the Mahatmas, those who possess this wisdom, are looking for companions because they can't be working here in our materialistic, polluted, especially mentally and emotionally, world. We're here. We can hold up the beacon of truth through our own efforts and study. So the introduction is one thing at the beginning, but as we keep studying, we keep meeting a new SD all the time because we have changed, we have grown, we have expanded, and And so we read what we couldn't see before. It's a true mystery, and everyone is invited to introduce themselves to that mystery. Yes?
So what you're saying is that if we want to change the world, we have to change the ideas that we see as truth.
And that we act upon. It's one thing to profess ideas, but you have to be watching yourself to see if you are living up to those ideas, or at least to understand why you're not living up to them. Yes?
Would you say that the old realm of esoteric life and all that would really be compared to somebody who's having a dream that's taking place underwater?
How do you dream underwater?
You know what I mean? But some are going to wake up in this dream, they're going to perceive they're drowning. You know what I mean? And other people, they're going to wake up and they're going to have a good time underwater.
I'm a Pisces, so I think
really
you lost me.
Facilitate your own experience. You know what I mean?
But the point is, in reality, what we're experiencing right now in this physical material world is underwater, is a dream, is a delusion, because we are thinkers, observers, spiritual beings acting through these physical forms. And we are all the time deluded because we don't recognize our own power. Yes?
Do you think that maybe we actually have the wrong perspective about the physically manifested world, and this is actually a big accomplishment for the spiritual realm to have manifested itself in such a way?
Well, the philosophy actually answers that question when it reminds us it is a privilege and an accomplishment to be born into a physical human life, because it's the only place where the thinker can gain experience, where you have contrast and choice. We have will and choice. Nothing else in the universe does. So it is an important point, but we're not supposed to be enamored of it and swimming underwater in it. We're supposed to be mentally present in it, mindful of who we are within it. And your questions are, do I think? It doesn't matter what I think. A student on the platform is responsible for saying what theosophy teaches, not what they think. Yes?
We just find so much of... We think one of the problems we have with studying VSD is that our mind thinks very concretely. And the readings in the SD, especially when she goes off, it's like we think we understand, and then she goes off on something else. And a couple pages later, she comes back, and we just have an awful time understanding.
Well, maybe part of what you're here for in this particular life is to break through that concreteness, to become more fluid and more intuitive. We're supposed to create for ourselves our own secret doctrine. So you could take the ideas that interrupt your flow of thought and put them aside. Not put them aside to forget about them, but put them aside for now and complete your thought. Skip what interrupts. And then when you're finished, go to what interrupted and see what you can understand from it. There's nothing in here that isn't important to the mind and heart of this century. Yes?
Somebody once told us that we really shouldn't sit down and try and read it from cover to cover.
Well, that's
that with the
page
index,
to page.
But with the index,
right.
Try and, you know, pick a
subject
topic and go through it that way.
Mm-hmm. But there are times when, let's say you're going to do an ocean summary, and you need this book as a reference. You would then read page to page on a particular subject. But the important thing is the mind and heart we bring to the study of the SD. You could read the poem for the rest of your life, and you would become wise in theosophy. Seeds, remember, seeds are always potent, and we always use the example of the acorn. If you have one acorn, you have enough oak trees to cover the face of this planet. Because an acorn produces an oak tree, which has how many acorns on it, which have how many acorns in themselves potentially. I mean, it doesn't matter what you choose to study. The study of it, the effort and the retaining of it will create within you a hunger for even those parts that you think are interruptions. Yes?
Well, I think in the secret doctrine they call this study Gupta Vidya,
mm-hmm.
or Raj Yoga, where one becomes in control of one's mental processes,
mm-hmm.
as well as one's physical.
Mm-hmm.
So that takes discipline, but there has to be a desire, some kind of burning desire to, you know, to do this for something more than ourselves, because otherwise I get old real quick.
Well, don't you think the desire that we have is, I want to know. I want to understand. I want to know why the world is beautiful and a mess. Why the people are wonderful and monstrous. I want to know. And the only way we're going to know is to be in control of our own nature so we understand it. Because we all have that same nature. The physical, selfish, demanding, and then the spiritual, compassionate, which is our real nature. But we've given up the fight for the most part. Yes.
Would you characterize the downfall of us, or like the glitch in our design or whatever, is just that impersonal approach to knowledge?
Well, the glitch in our design isn't a glitch at all.
Well, I think it's an unspeakable presence.
Well, the philosophy, we're here to discuss theosophy, and theosophy teaches that the fall is the plan. The spiritual beings, which we are in reality, are wise and compassionate and have a desire to come and to share and to be of help. Once we enter into this plane, we are dual. We have a lower personal nature that is ours to use and control, and we have our own divine nature. But within the mind of the human being, there is that, you call it the flaw. But
well,
it,
that's just a cute name.
Yeah, it's not.
Take the word however it needs to happen. You know,
it isn't cute in reality, though, is it? When we look around the world, we have divorced ourselves mentally from our spiritual nature. And as long as we don't realize that it is our spiritual power that creates all the wrong, all the evil, all the cruelty. It is because we are power and have will and choice. So the tragedy is that we are that divinity and we waste it in pitiful ways. So the fall is part of the process, because if we weren't here, we could not learn from contrast. If you're in a pure spiritual bliss state, you can't learn anything. Yes. Yes.
This might sound a little strange, but actually, my experience with researching in the secret doctrine reminds me of music.
Mm-hmm.
Inasmuch as it's not so much words, it's something that reaches beyond words. In other words, the secret doctrine, regardless of what language it's in, what language you perceive, it has the power to impress upon you facts and truths that usually would be way over your head.
And to wake up music in your mind.
Exactly.
It's music.
Exactly. There's a part when she speaks about different strata of land existing on one side of the Atlantic, and on the other side have to exist somewhere in the middle. Well, you know, I mean, you sit back and it's, you just heard a John Coltrane solo. You
mm-hmm.
just, you know,
it's a delight. It really
exactly.
is. But that's because you approach it with a hunger. If we're hungry for wisdom, really hungry for it, not to show it off, not to brag about it, but hungry because we need it, it will find us. A book will fall off a shelf, or someone will say, you want to read this? I can't understand it. You will find that wisdom seeks you out. So once you start appreciating that it is a kind of music, and we're the sheet that the music is written upon. You know, there's fascinating things when you think about music. Maybe everyone's familiar with Handel's Messiah. He wrote it in 6 weeks. We think if you were a professional scribe who copies musical things, we don't think a professional scribe could copy the whole of the Messiah in 6 weeks. We have no idea how he did it. So he was in an altered state. Well, sometimes when we're studying, we're in an altered state. When we come down from it, it's not as usable as we think it should be. We don't have the vocabulary and the experience, but we can earn it, yes.
That same experience follows us in sleep, in
mm-hmm.
mornings when you wake up, you don't know why, you just feel energized and so alive that it's something that has come to you in sleep that you cannot tell somebody about. There's no words.
Oh, there are words.
Oh.
No, we have it in the philosophy that the sleeping time of the body is first a dreaming state that allows us to let go of everything, and then we enter deep sleep. If you read about deep sleep, you almost want to weep, because it is said in the deep sleep state, we are all one. And that means we're one with the Buddha, we're one with Christ, we're one with Krishna, we're one with our enemies, we're one with our friends that maybe have died, we have lost. We are all one, and communicate our needs and get wisdom. It is a secret doctrine, the after sleep, deep sleep state. When we wake in the morning, we have to come back through the dreaming state. And in doing so, we color all of these experiences and wisdom that we've received. And we may wake up with that feeling of bliss and harmony, health and strength. We may wake up forgetting all of it. It's up to us. If we practice some mindfulness, do some meditating, reading a spiritual book before we go to sleep, put the mundane world aside, we may get more memory when we awaken in the morning. We should not jump right out of bed either, but lie there and let it happen. Yes.
So that daily or nightly,
or both,
that state that we go into in the deep sleep where we are all one, we must bring something back. And we think that things would probably be far worse in the world if we didn't have that
core.
Yeah.
But we don't necessarily bring anything back in memory. And if we do, if we awaken with a significant dream, and we know it's significant, it not only had meaning for us, but it was so vivid, we can know that that was an experience and something important for us as a soul. So we should write such things down. Yes. Very funny. If you read what HPB wrote about mistaken notions about the secret doctrine, an article of hers, she says it was originally intended to be an expansion of Isis. But then she explains that that isn't what it is at all. It's not what the masters wanted us to have. Isis, you can read page to page, chapter to chapter, and it's a fascinating work. But it isn't necessary as a precursor to the secret doctrine. The really funny thing is the precursor and the after work of the secret doctrine is the voice of the silence. It's from the same stanzas and thinking as this book. It's the devotional side of this book. So it isn't necessary to read Isis. The other thing is the book, The Key to Theosophy, which we're studying on Wednesday nights, is an introduction to the secret doctrine because it gives us all of those key ideas. Yes. Absolutely. It is the reference book for theosophy, but it is also something much deeper and grander and requires something of us. So people who just use it as a reference are wasting something priceless because it will change you. Yes. No, there are hints at that, certainly, in this manuscript. Now, here's a funny thing. It's going to sound very strange. Because you have thought about this in order to bring it up as a subject, it's kind of a burden on you to pursue it. You should be writing for the rest of us what you see as lacking, so that we can look at it and understand it. There are amazing, wonderful things about South America that HPB did write about. I think it's called A Land of Mystery, and she did cover it. In our books on reincarnation that were actually written by ULT students, and they're very, very well-known, well-received books, there's a whole thing on African religions and how they point to the same enduring truths. So some people have made the effort, but we think if you have an interest, if you find yourself pulled towards something, go after it. Do the work. Write it down. Share it with others so that they go, oh, you know, I never thought about that. There's a wonderful, wonderful documentary that some brilliant person made that shows all these different locations in South America, in various countries, not just one country. And there are what they call ley lines between them. In other words, this one here and this one here, it's a straight line, and then that straight line follows to the next one. So there's all of this mystery about connection and wisdom in the past, and we should know about it. Yes.
You stumped me. I had a great. Oh, what do you think her original intent for writing all this information down? Because I feel like it's something that's already available to us to just ponder as children. You know, just to look at life and say, "Well, what is this?" You know, and just get to know it personally. Is there a reason? Was she trying to create a dialogue back then? Like, was it that there was some? Because you think about the Thelema.
What?
Thelema and all the dark magic that was going on. Was she trying to equip people to protect themselves? Was it that bold?
The only protection we ever have is our own motive.
Or understanding.
And action. Well, you cannot understand something completely
still
hold the right motive about it. It's like the Hippocratic Oath. We're not seeking to do any harm. We're here to help if we can. That's a motive. We may not understand it completely, but if we can hold to it. But the whole point of giving out these teachings was the world was roaring towards materialism, was already ripe with superstition and spiritualism and all kinds of use of psychic powers, and the warnings that as spiritual beings, you don't know your motive on this plane for the why you are doing something. So if you think that psychism is spiritual, you're very much mistaken. It is a different kind of physical. Mm-hmm. So our use of our powers is distortion. And we need the wisdom, just like when you're little children, you need to learn things from those who know. So the writings are to educate us. And yes, we should write and help and carry on for others. Yes.
And we also have to see Blavatsky as a link in the chain of a tremendous effort that's been going on globally forever, and certainly since the days of Tsongkhapa.
Right.
So all those centuries of the last 25 years were all stages of readiness so that this could be published, so that it's the birthright of every single human being.
And even the founding of the United States is based on the same thing. It's the last 25 years of every century are devoted to an effort of that great brotherhood, because of a cycle established in 1375 by Tsongkhapa in Tibet, when he called all of the adepts together to make this effort. And you can follow it like 1475, the Renaissance. In 1575 and 16 and 17, it's all that same effort to bring the right of the spiritual being to be aware and present, and you are not a physical being, to make that stressed.
We get to facilitate how the spiritual plays out. I think that's the fun part of being a physical person, but I think that it finds its own limitations.
We also facilitate the exact opposite. We start wars and we steal from people and we do terrible things. So we need to ever have these ideas in front of us. One of the
there is a way to
wait a second. HPB wrote, the work is too gigantic for any one person to undertake. Far more to accomplish. Our main concern was simply to prepare the soil. This, we trust, we have done. These two volumes only constitute the work of a pioneer who has forced his way into the well-nigh impenetrable jungle of the virgin forest of the land of the occult. A commencement has been made to fell and uproot the trees of superstition, prejudice, and conceited ignorance. So it isn't a question of just relying on what we already have. We have to encourage ourselves and each other to learn what this is, to make that connection with that wisdom. Yes. Okay, if we can interrupt you for just a second, you're leaving a clause out of there. That is absolutely true. Karma will come and do all that, but it does not take away our will to change our attitude about what it is. So it isn't fatalism. It may be miserable, but nobody makes us stay in it. Go on.
Peaceful
ages.
It's
the iron age as well, and we know iron is hard to work. If it weren't for this age, we would be plodding along to try to change something. If you've ever given up a habit in this life, any kind of habit, physical, emotional, mental, you know it's hard work, but you can do it. In another age, it might take you 3, 4, 5 lifetimes to make such a change. We can do things almost overnight, but we have to make the effort through will and choice, as you said. Yes?
Well, then we're all crackpots.
Did you say crackpots?
Crackpots.
No, cracked pots.
Yes. There is a piece of art called fractureware. And we have to back together just as it was originally, and that requires knowledge, patience, and understanding. Otherwise, we'll never get each piece to fit exactly where it's going.
You know, there is a Japanese art form that takes a broken thing and turns the breaks into part of the beauty. We can be proud if we have accomplished something. I mean, maybe turned ourselves around in a certain direction. Even things that other people might think are simple. There was a book written years ago called The Mutant Messenger Down Under. It's an absolutely delightful story. It may not be a story. It may be a record of a event in actual life. But one of the things that the Australian Aborigines teach the woman who is writing this story is that they never celebrate birthdays. And that's reasonable, because all you did was show up. Why should you celebrate it? What they celebrate is an accomplishment. So if you have solved something, changed something in yourself, made something better, you have a party, and you give yourself a new name to, as part of your other name, as a way to honor that. And we think that's a great idea, to take note of yourself in the negative and in the positive. Why not? Yes.
Well, in the idea of masters, that we need an ideal in which we need to strive.
Right.
To become, or we have a goal, you know. But the idea of harmony is something that we have to make inside of ourselves, because we are the ones that are out of harmony.
Yes.
You know, like being impatient or annoyed or just the little things, and then after a while something comes out of our mouth that isn't positive.
Right.
It's negative. So all this is really going on in our own psyche, and if we can, through the devotional books or whatever, I mean, they for those of us that are weak and that need to be reminded over and over again that we are these divine beings.
Well, the funny thing is, we're not weak. We are powerful. We have created situations of weakness.
Right.
But we're not weak. You know, the thing about harmony is, if you stop and think about it, the masters, why do they keep coming cycle after cycle? Or if even if they don't come, sending out their representatives, because they believe in us. Because they know that we're identical to them. The difference is in degree of knowledge, of experience, of ability to act on that knowledge. So the masters love humanity and serve humanity. They get nothing from it but the fact that they love us, their younger brothers. And we are brothers to them, the same in essence. So if we could realize that in spite of the way we act and think and feel, they continue to make an effort for us. Well, we should be able to do that for others and for ourselves. It isn't just a lack of harmony with the world, it's a lack of harmony with ourselves. And every time we start to argue with ourselves, where we don't want to do what's our duty or what we know we should do, and we come up with excuses, that's when we should say, aha, something is going on here. There is a war here. And that's why we study the Bhagavad Gita, to understand that what we need is wisdom. We're acting in ignorance, in blindness. It shouldn't have to be that way. You mentioned yoga, and in Commander Bowen's work, HPB talked about Jnana Yoga, J-N-A-N-A, and that every student of the secret doctrine is a Jnana Yoga, yogi, and this path of yoga is the true path for the Western student. It is to provide him with signposts to that path that the secret doctrine has been written, and that is jhana, wisdom, knowledge. We need it. We can't just go on in our ignorance making more and more trouble. We can't change the world, except we can change ourselves, and that does change the world. Well, we remind you that you can pick up a copy of the reading, which comes from the preface, and on the back of it are excerpts from Commander Bowen's How to Study the Secret Doctrine. The effort, if it's made from the right motive, that you want to understand yourself so that you may be more of a representative of spirituality than materiality or personality, if you have that motive and you make this effort, in your next life, you will be closer to that wisdom, because you will start with that as the premise. That'll be the foundation. And you will know and recognize these truths earlier. You won't have to wait until you're older. We have 1 minute.
If someone had a shortcut, how many people would be willing to take it?
Well, there is no shortcut to wisdom. There are individuals who, once they touch this wisdom again, it does open up for them. But that isn't going to open it up for anybody else.
Right.
So the shortcut is the efforts that we have made in past lives, and we have no idea. And we have no idea why certain things stand in the way in front of us until we solve them. And once we solve them, we will have additional power and wisdom. It's our own faults that keep us nailed to the ground where we are. There's not enough time. Next Sunday, our talk is the unity of all, we believe. Wait, let's do it correctly. The unity of life. An entire month of November will be basic theosophical principles. Meeting is adjourned.